Book 4 Chapter 25 Catherine's car was in the driveway of the hotel when they drove up. It was parked on the right side of the graveled approach. David stopped the Asada behind it, and he and Marita got out and walked down the drive past the small, low, empty blue car and onto the flagstones of the walk without speaking. They passed David's room with the locked door and the open windows, and Marita stopped outside of her door and said,
"Goodbye."
"What are you doing this afternoon?" he asked.
"I don't know," she said. "I'll be here."
He walked on down to the patio of the hotel and went in the main door. Catherine was sitting at the bar reading the Paris Herald with a glass and half a bottle of wine beside her on the bar. She looked up at him.
"What brought you back?" she asked.
"We had lunch in town and came on up," David said.
"How is your whore?"
"I haven't one yet."
"I mean the one you write the stories for."
"Oh, the stories."
"Yes, the stories. The dreary, dismal little stories about your adolescence with your bogus, drunken father."
"He wasn't so bogus, really."
"Didn't he defraud his wife and all his friends?"
"No, just himself, really."
"You certainly make him despicable in these last sketches or vignettes or pointless anecdotes you write about him."
"You mean the stories?"
"You call them stories," Catherine said.
"Yes," David said, and poured a glass of the lovely cold wine on the bright clear day in the pleasant sunny room in the clean, comfortable hotel and, sipping it, felt it fail to lift up his dead, cold heart.
"Would you like me to go and get Eris?" Catherine said. "It wouldn't do to have her think that we'd had a misunderstanding about whose day it is or that we'd taken up solitary drinking together."
"You don't need to get her."
"I'd like to. She took care of you today, and I didn't. Really, David, I'm not a bitch yet. I just act and talk like one."
While David waited for Catherine to come back, he drank another glass of the champagne and read the Paris edition of the New York Herald she had left on the bar. Drinking the wine by himself, it did not taste the same, and he found a cork in the kitchen to stop up the bottle before he put it back in the ice chest. But the bottle did not feel heavy enough, and lifting it against the light that came in the west window, he saw how little wine was left, and he poured it out and drank it off and put the bottle down on the tiled floor. Even when he drank it off quickly, it did nothing for him. Thank God he was breaking through on the stories now. What had made the last book good was the people who were in it and the accuracy of the detail which made it believable. He had really only to remember accurately, and the form came by what he would choose to leave out. Then, of course, he could close it like the diaphragm of a camera and intensify it so it could be concentrated to the point where the heat shone bright and the smoke began to rise. He knew that he was getting this now. What Catherine had said about the stories when she was trying to hurt him had started him thinking about his father and all the things he had tried to do whatever he could about. Now, he told himself, you must try to grow up again and face what you have to face without being irritable or hurt that someone did not understand and appreciate what you wrote. She understands it less and less, but you've worked well and nothing can touch you as long as you can work. Try to help her now and forget about yourself. Tomorrow you have the story to go over and to make perfect. But David did not want to think about the story. He cared about the writing more than about anything else. And he cared about many things, but he knew that when he was doing it, he must not worry about it, nor finger it, nor handle it any more than he would open up the door of the dark room to see how a negative was developing. Leave it alone, he told himself. You are a bloody fool, but you know that much. His thoughts turned to the two girls, and he wondered if he should go find them and see what they wanted to do, or if they wanted to go off and swim. After all, it was Marita's in his day, and she might be waiting. Maybe something could still be salvaged out of the day for all of them. They might be cooking something up. He ought to go by and ask what they wanted to do. Then do it, he told himself. Don't stand here and think about it. Go on and find them. The door to Marita's room was shut, and he knocked on it. They had been talking, and when he knocked, the talking stopped.
Who is it? Marita asked.
He heard Catherine laugh, and she said,
Come in, whoever you are.
He heard Marita say something to her, and Catherine said,
Come in, David.
He opened the door. They were lying in the big bed together, side by side, the sheet pulled up under their chins.
"Please come in, David," Catherine said. "We've been waiting for you."
David looked at them, the serious, dark girl and the fair, laughing one. Marita looked at him, trying to tell him something. Catherine was laughing.
"Won't you come in too, David?"
"I came by to see if you wanted to go swim or anything," David said.
"I don't want to," Catherine said. "Eris was in bed asleep, and I got into bed with her. She was very good and asked me to leave. She's not a bit unfaithful to you, not in the least little bit. But won't you come in too so we can both be faithful to you?"
"No," David said.
"Please, David," Catherine said. "It's such a lovely day."
"Do you want to go to swim?" David asked Marita.
"I'd like to," the girl said above the sheet.
"You two Puritans," Catherine said.
"Please both be reasonable and come to bed, David."
"I want to go to swim," Marita said. "Please go out, David."
"Why can't he see you?" Catherine asked. "He sees you at the beach."
"He'll see me at the cove," Marita said. "Please go out, David."
David went out and closed the door without looking back, hearing Marita talking in a low voice to Catherine and Catherine's laughter. He walked down the flagstones to the front of the hotel and looked out at the sea. There was a light breeze now, and he watched three French destroyers and a cruiser, neat and dark and sharply etched on the blue sea as they moved in formation, working out some problems. They were far out, and they looked to be recognition silhouettes from their size, until a white line would show at the bow as a ship speeded up to change the pattern. David watched them until the two girls came up to him.
"Please don't be cross," Catherine said.
They were dressed to go to the beach, and Catherine put a bag with the towels and the robes on an iron chair.
"Are you going swimming too?" David said to her.
"If you're not angry with me."
David said nothing and watched the ships as they changed course, and another destroyer moved out of the pattern at a sharp angle with the line of white curling back from her bows. She began to make smoke, and it trailed in a black, widening plume as she curved at flank speed.
"It was only a joke," Catherine said. "We've been making such good rough jokes. You and I had."
"What are they doing, David?" Marita asked.
"Anti-sub maneuvers, I think," he said. "Maybe there are subs working with them. They're probably out from Toulon."
"They were in Saint-Maxime or Saint-Raphael," Catherine said. "I saw them the other day."
"I don't know what it is now with the smoke screen," David said. "There must be other ships we can't see."
"There come the planes," Marita said. "Aren't they lovely?"
They were very small, neat seaplanes, and three of them were coming around the point, low over the water.
"When we were here in the early summer, they had gunnery practice off the Pork Roll, and it was terrific," Catherine said. "It shook the window. Will they use depth bombs now, David?"
"I don't know. I shouldn't think so if they're working with real subs."
"I can go to swim, can't I please, David?" Catherine asked. "I'm going away, and then you can swim all the time by yourselves."
"I asked you to swim," David said.
"That's true," Catherine said. "You did. Then let's go now and all be friends and happy. If the planes come in close, they can see us on the beach at the cove, and that will cheer them up."
The planes did come by close off the cove while David and Marita were swimming far out and Catherine was tanning on the beach. They passed rapidly, three echelons of three, their big roan motors roaring suddenly as they flew over, then dying away as they went towards Saint-Maxime. David and Marita swam back into the beach and sat on the sand by Catherine.
"They never even looked at me," Catherine said. "They must be very serious boys."
"What did you expect? Aerial photography?" David asked her. Marita had said very little since they had left the hotel, and she said nothing to this.
"It was fun when David really did live with me," Catherine said to her. "I can remember when I liked everything that David did. You must try to like his things too, Eris. That is, if he has any left." "Do you have any left, David?" Marita asked.
"He traded everything he had in on those stories," Catherine said.
"He used to have so many things. I certainly hope you like stories, Eris."
"I like them," Marita said.
She did not look at David, but he saw her serene dark face and sea-wet hair and smooth, lovely skin and her beautiful body as she sat looking out at the sea.
"That's good," Catherine said lazily. and took a long, deep, lazy breath as she stretched out on the beach robe on the sand that was still warm from the afternoon sun.
Because that's what you're going to get. He used to do so many things, too, and he did them all so beautifully. He had a wonderful life, and all he thinks about now is Africa, and his drunken father, and his press cuttings, his clippings. Has he ever shown you his clippings, Eris?
No, Catherine, Marita said.
He will, Catherine said. He tried to show them to me once at Le Gros du Roi, but I put a stop to that. There were hundreds of them, and every one, almost, had his picture, and they were all the same pictures. It's worse than carrying around obscene postcards, really. I think he reads them by himself and is unfaithful to me with them. In a wastebasket, probably. He always has a wastebasket. He said himself it was the most important thing for a writer.
Let's go in and swim, Catherine, Marita said. I think I'm getting cold.
I mean, the wastebasket was the most important thing for a writer, Catherine said. I used to think I ought to get him a really wonderful one that would be worthy of him. But he never puts anything he writes in the wastebasket. He writes in those ridiculous child's notebooks, and he doesn't throw anything away. He just crosses things out and writes along the sides of the pages. The whole business is a fraud, really. He makes mistakes in spelling and grammar, too. Did you know, Marita, that he doesn't even really know grammar?
Poor David, Marita said.
Of course, his French is worse, Catherine said. You've never seen him try to write it. He fakes along well enough in conversation, and he's amusing with his slang. But actually, he's illiterate.
Too bad, said David.
I thought he was wonderful, Catherine said, until I found he couldn't write even a simple note correctly.
But then you'll be able to write in French for him.
Tagul, David said cheerfully.
He's good at that sort of thing, Catherine said. Quick tags of slang that are probably outdated before he knows it. He speaks very idiomatic French, but he can't write it at all. He's really illiterate, Marita, and you have to face it. His handwriting is terrible, too. He can't write like a gentleman nor speak like one in any language, especially not his own.
Poor David, Marita said.
I can't say I've given him the best years of my life, Catherine said, because I've only lived with him since March, I think it was, but I've certainly given him the best months of my life. The ones I've had the most fun in, anyway. And he certainly made them fun, too. I wish it hadn't ended in complete disillusion, too. But what are you to do if you discover the man is illiterate and practices solitary vice in a wastebasket full of clippings from something called the original Romaikes, whoever they are? Any girl would be discouraged, and frankly, I'm not going to put up with it.
You take the clippings and burn them, David said. That would be the soundest thing.
Wouldn't you like to go in now and swim, devil?
Catherine looked at him slyly.
How did you know I did it? She asked.
Did what?
Burned the clippings.
Did you, Catherine? Marita asked.
Of course I did, Catherine said.
David stood looking at her. He felt completely hollow. It was like coming around a curve on a mountain road and the road not being there and only a gulf ahead. Marita was standing now, too. Catherine was looking at them, her face calm and reasonable.
Let's go in and swim, Marita said. We'll just swim out to the point and back.
I'm glad you're being pleasant, finally, Catherine said. I've been wanting to go in for a long time. It's really getting quite cool. We forget it's September.
Chapter 26. They dressed on the beach and climbed up the steep trail with David carrying the bag with the beach things to where the old car was waiting in the pine woods. They got in and David drove back to the hotel in the early evening light. Catherine was quiet in the car, and to anyone passing them, they might have been returning from any afternoon at one of the unfrequented beaches of the Estoril. The warships were no longer in sight when they left the car on the driveway, and the sea beyond the pines was blue and calm. The evening was as beautiful and clear as the morning had been. They walked down to the entrance of the hotel, and David took the bag with the beach things into the storeroom and put it down.
Let me take them, Catherine said. They ought to go to dry.
I'm sorry, David said. He turned at the door of the storeroom and walked out and then down to his workroom at the end of the hotel.
Inside the room, he opened the big Vuitton suitcase. The pile of cahiers that the stories had been written in was gone. So were the four bulky envelopes from the bank that had contained the press clippings. The pile of cahiers with the narrative written in them were intact. He closed and locked the suitcase and searched all the drawers in the armoire and searched the room. He had not believed that the stories could be gone. He had not believed that she could do it. At the beach, he had known that she might have done it, but it had seemed impossible, and he had not really believed it. They had been calm and careful and restrained about it, as you were trained to be in danger or emergency or in disaster, but it had not seemed possible that it could really have happened. Now he knew that it had happened, but still thought it might be some ghastly joke. So, empty and dead in his heart, he reopened the suitcase and checked it, and after he locked it, he checked the room again. Now there was no danger and no emergency. It was only disaster now. But it couldn't be. She must have hidden them someplace. They could be in the storeroom, or in their own room. Or she could have put them in Marita's room. She couldn't really have destroyed them. No one could do that to a fellow human being. He still could not believe that she had done it, but he felt sick inside himself when he closed and locked the door. The two girls were at the bar when David came in. Marita looked up at him and saw how things were, and Catherine watched him come in by looking at the mirror. She did not look at him, only at his reflection in the mirror. "Where did you put them, devil?" David asked. She turned away from the mirror and looked at him. "I won't tell you," she said. "I took care of them." "I wish you'd tell me," David said, "because I need them very much." "No, you don't," she said. "They were worthless, and I hated them." "Not the one about Kibo," David said. "You loved Kibo, don't you remember?" "He had to go too. I was going to tear him out and keep him, but I couldn't find him. Anyway, you said he was dead." David saw Marita look at her and look away. Then she looked back. "Where did you burn them, Catherine?" "I won't tell you either," Catherine said. "You're part of the same thing."
"Did you burn them with the clippings?" David asked.
"I won't tell you," Catherine said. "You talk to me like a policeman or at school."
"Tell me, devil, I only want to know."
"I paid for them," Catherine said. "I paid the money to do them."
"I know," David said. "It was very generous of you. Where did you burn them, devil?"
"I won't tell her."
"No, just tell me."
"Ask her to go away." "I really have to go anyway," Marita said. "I'll see you later, Catherine."
"That's good," Catherine said.
"It wasn't your fault, Eris."
David sat on the tall stool by Catherine, and she looked in the mirror and watched Marita go out of the room.
"Where did you burn them, devil?" David asked. "You can tell me now."
"She wouldn't understand," Catherine said. "That's why I wanted her to go."
"I know," said David. "Where did you burn them, devil?"
"In the iron drum with holes that Madame uses to burn trash," Catherine said.
"Did everything burn up?"
"Yes. I poured on some petrol from a bidon in the remise. It made a big fire and everything burned. I did it for you, David, and for all of us."
"I'm sure you did," David said. "Did everything burn?"
"Oh, yes. We can go out and look if you'd like, but it isn't necessary. The paper all burned black, and I stirred it up with a stick."
"I'll just go out and have a look," David said.
"But you'll be back," Catherine said.
"Sure," David said.
The burning had been in the trash burner, which was a former 55-gallon gasoline drum with holes punched in it. The stick used to stir the ashes, and still freshly blackened on one end, was an old broom handle which had been used in this capacity before. The bidon was in the stone shed and contained kerosene. In the drum were a few identifiable charred bits of the green covers of the cahiers, and David found scraps of burnt newsprint and two charred bits of pink paper, which he identified as those used by the Romankis clipping service. On one he could distinguish the Providence, Rhode Island dateline. The ashes had been well stirred, but there would doubtless have been more unburned or charred material if he had cared to sift or examine them patiently. He tore the pink paper with Providence, Rhode Island printed on it into small pieces
and dropped them in the former gasoline drum which he had replaced in an upright position. He reflected that he had never been in Providence, Rhode Island, and replacing the broom handle in the stone shed, where he noticed the presence of his racing bicycle, the tires of which needed inflation, he re-entered the kitchen of the hotel, which was empty, and proceeded to the salon where he joined his wife, Catherine, at the bar.
"Wasn't it just the way I said?" Catherine asked.
"Yes," David said, and sat down on one of the stools and put his elbows on the bar.
"It probably would have been enough to burn the clippings," Catherine said. "But I really thought I ought to make a clean sweep."
"You did all right," David said.
"Now you can go right on with the narrative and there will be nothing to interrupt you. You can start in the morning."
"Sure," David said.
"I'm glad you're reasonable about it," Catherine said. "You couldn't know how worthless they were, David. I had to show you."
"You couldn't have kept the Kibo one that you liked?"
"I told you I tried to find it. But if you want to rewrite it, I can tell it to you word for word."
"That will be fun."
"It will be, really. You'll see. Do you want me to tell it to you now? We could if you want."
"No," David said. "Not just now."
"Would you write it, though?" "I can't write things, David. You know that. But I can tell it to you anytime you want." "You don't really care about the others, do you? They were worthless."
"Why did you do it, really?"
"To help you. You can go to Africa and write them again when your viewpoint is more mature. The country can't be changed very much. I think it would be nice if you wrote about Spain instead, though. You said the country was almost the same as Africa, and there you'd have the advantage of a civilized language."
David poured himself a whiskey and found a bottle of Perrier, uncapped it, and poured some in the glass. He remembered the day they had passed the place where they bottled Perrier water on the plane on the way to Egg Mort, and how... "Let's not talk about writing," he said to Catherine.
"I like to," Catherine said, "when it's constructive and has some valid purpose. You always wrote so well until you started those stories. The worst thing was the dirt and the flies and the cruelty and the bestiality. You seemed almost to grovel in it. That horrible one about the massacre in the crater and the heartlessness of your own father?"
"Can we not talk about them?" David asked.
"I want to talk about them," Catherine said. "I want to make you realize why it was necessary to burn them."
"Write it out," David said. "I'd rather not hear it now."
"But I can't write things, David."
"You will," David said.
"No, but I'll tell them to someone who can write them," Catherine said. "If you were friendly, you'd write them for me. If you really loved me, you'd be happy to."
"All I want to do is kill you," David said. "And the only reason I don't do it is because you are crazy."
"You can't talk to me like that, David."
"No?"
"No, you can't. You can't. Do you hear me?"
"I hear you."
"Then hear me say you can't say such things. You can't say horrible things like that to me."
"I hear you," David said.
"You can't say such things. I won't stand for it. I'll divorce you."
"That would be very welcome."
"Then I'll stay married to you and never give you a divorce."
"That would be pretty."
"I'll do anything I want to you."
"You have."
"I'll kill you."
"I wouldn't give a shit," David said.
"You can't even talk like a gentleman at a time like this."
"What would a gentleman say at a time like this?"
"That he was sorry."
"All right," David said. "I'm sorry. I'm sorry I ever met you. I'm sorry I ever married you."
"So am I."
"Shut up, please. You can tell to somebody who can write it down. I'm sorry your mother ever met your father and that they ever made you. I'm sorry you were born and that you grew up. I'm sorry for everything we ever did, good or bad."
"You're not."
"No," he said. "I'll shut up."
"I didn't mean to make a speech." "You're just really sorry for yourself."
"Possibly," David said.
"But shit, devil. Why did you have to burn them, the stories?" "I had to, David," she said. "I'm sorry if you don't understand."
He had understood really before he had asked her the question, and the question had been, he realized, a rhetorical one. He disliked rhetoric, and distrusted those who used it, and he was ashamed to have fallen into it. He drank the whiskey and Perrier slowly while he thought how untrue it was that everything that was understood was forgiven,
and he tightened his own discipline as conscientiously as he would have worked in the old days with the mechanic and the armorer going over the plane, the engine, and his guns. It was not necessary then because they did the work perfectly, but it was one way of not thinking, and it was, to use a wet word, comforting. Now it was necessary because what he had said to Catherine about killing her, he had said quite truly, and not rhetorically. He was ashamed of the speech which had followed the statement. But there was nothing he could do about the statement which was truly made, except tighten his discipline so that he would have it in case he began to lose control. He poured himself another whiskey and put in Perrier again, and watched the small bubbles form and break. God damn her to hell, he thought. I'm sorry to be stuffy, he said. I understand, of course.
I'm so glad, David, she said.
I'm going away in the morning.
Where?
To Ondé and then to Paris to see about artists for the book.
Really?
Yes, I think I should. We've wasted time as it is, and today I made so much progress that I just need to keep on.
How are you going?
With the bug.
You shouldn't drive alone.
I want to.
You shouldn't, devil, really. I couldn't let you.
Can I go on the train? There's one to Bayonne. I can rent a car there or in Biarritz.
Can we talk about it in the morning?
I want to talk about it now.
You shouldn't go, devil.
I'm going, she said. You're not going to stop me.
I'm only thinking about the best way.
No, you're not. You're trying to stop me.
If you wait, we'll go together.
I don't want to go together. I want to go tomorrow and in the bug. If you don't agree, I'll go by train. You can't stop anyone from going on the train. I'm of age, and because I'm married to you doesn't make me your slave or your chattel. I'm going, and you can't stop me.
Will you be coming back?
I plan to.
I see.
You don't see, but it doesn't make any difference. This is a reasoned and coordinated project. These things aren't just tossed off.
Into a wastebasket, David said, and remembered the discipline and sipped the whiskey and Perrier. Are you going to see your lawyers in Paris? He asked.
If I have any business with them. I usually see my lawyers. Just because you don't have any lawyers doesn't mean everyone else doesn't have to see their lawyers. Do you want my lawyers to do anything for you?
No, David said. Fuck your lawyers.
Do you have plenty of money?
I'm quite all right on money.
Really, David? Weren't the stories worth a lot? It's bothered me terribly, and I know my responsibility. I'll find out and do exactly what I should.
You'll what?
Do exactly what I should.
Just what is it you propose to do?
I'll have their value determined, and I'll have twice that paid into your bank.
Sounds very generous, David said. You are always generous.
I want to be just, David, and it's possible that they were worth, financially, much more than they would be appraised at.
Who appraises these things?
There must be people who do. There are people who appraise everything.
What sort of people?
I wouldn't know, David. But I can imagine such people as the editor of Atlantic Monthly, Harper's, La Nouvelle Revue Française.
I'm going out for a while, David said.
Do you feel all right? Except for the fact that I feel I've probably done a great wrong to you that I must try to set right, I feel very well, Catherine said. That was one reason I was going to Paris. I didn't want to tell you.
Let's not discuss casualties, David said. So you want to go on the train?
No, I want to go in the bug.
All right, go in the bug. Just drive carefully and don't pass on hills.
I'll drive the way you taught me, and I'll pretend you're with me all the time and talk to you and tell us stories and make up stories about how I saved your life. I always make those up. And with you, it will all seem so much shorter and effortless, and the speed won't seem fast. I'm going to have fun.
Good, said David. Take it as easy as you can. Sleep at Nîmes the first night unless you get off early.
They know us at the Imperator. I thought I'd get to Carcassonne.
No, devil, please.
Perhaps I can get off early and make Carcassonne. I'd go by Arles and Montpellier and not lose time by Nîmes.
If you get off late, stop at Nîmes.
It seems so babyish, she said.
I'll drive with you, he said. I should.
No, please. It's important that I do this by myself. It really is.
I wouldn't have you.
All right, he said, but I ought to go.
Please don't. You must have confidence in me, David. I'll drive carefully, and I'll drive it right straight through.
You couldn't, devil. It gets dark early now.
You mustn't worry. You're sweet to let me go, Catherine said.
But you always did. If I did anything I shouldn't, I hope you can forgive me.
I'll miss you terribly. I miss you already.
Next time we'll drive it together.
You've had a very busy day, David said. You're tired. At least let me run your Bugatti down to town and back and give it a check. He stopped at Marita's door and said, Do you want to go for a ride?
Yes, she said.
Come on then, he told her.
Chapter 27 David got into the car and Marita climbed in beside him, and he put the car at a stretch of road where the sand drifted across from the beach, and then throttled back and held it in, watching the papyrus grass ahead on his left and the empty beach and the sea on his right as he saw the black road ahead. He put the car at the road again until he saw the white painted bridge coming at him fast. Then he held his speed as he calculated the distance, raised his foot from the throttle, and pumped the brakes gently. She was steady and lost momentum at each pump with no deviation and no binding. He brought the car to a stop before the bridge, downshifted, and then put her at the road again in a rising disciplined snarl along the N6 to Khan.
She burned them all, he said.
Oh, David, Marita said.
And they drove on into Khan where the lights were on now, and David stopped the car under the trees in front of the cafe where they had first met.
Wouldn't you rather go somewhere else? Marita asked.
I don't care, David said. It doesn't make a hell of a lot of difference.
If you'd rather just drive, Marita offered.
No, I'd rather cool out, David said. I just wanted to see if the car was in shape for her to drive it.
She's going?
She says so.
They were sitting at the table on the terrace in the dappled shadow of the leaves of the trees. The waiter had brought Marita a Tio Pepe and David a whiskey and Perrier.
Do you want me to go with her? Marita said.
You don't really think anything will happen to her?
No, David. I think she's done her damage for a while.
Could be, David said. She burned every fucking thing except the narrative, the stuff about her.
It's a wonderful narrative, Marita said.
Don't buck me up, David said. I wrote it, and I wrote what she burned. Don't give me the stuff they feed the troops.
You can write them again.
No, David told her. When it's right, you can't remember. Every time you read it again, it comes as a great and unbelievable surprise. You can't believe you did it. When it's once right, you can never do it again. You only do it once for each thing. And you're only allowed so many in your life.
So many what?
So many good ones.
But you can remember them. You must.
Not me, and not you, and not anybody. They're gone. Once I get them right, they're gone.
She was wicked to you.
No, David said.
What then?
Hurried, David said.
Everything today was because she was hurried, really. I hope you'll be as kind to me.
You just stay around and help me not to kill her. You know what she's going to do, don't you? She's going to pay me for the story so that I won't lose anything.
No.
Yes, she is. She's going to have her lawyers have them appraised in some fantastic Rube Goldberg manner, and then she's going to pay me double the appraisal price.
Truly, David, she didn't say that.
She said it, and it's infinitely sound. Only the details need working out, and what's more, the doubling of the appraisal or whatever makes it generous and gives her pleasure.
You can't let her drive alone, David.
I know it.
What are you going to do?
I don't know. But let's sit here for a little while, David said. There isn't any hurry now. I think she's probably tired and gone to sleep. I'd like to go to sleep too, with you, and wake up and find the stuff all there and not gone and go to work again.
We will sleep, and someday when you wake up, you'll work as wonderfully as you did this morning.
You're awfully good, David said. But you certainly got into a fine lot of trouble when you came in here that night, didn't you?
Don't try to put me outside, Marita said.
I know what I got into.
Sure, said David. We both know. Do you want another drink?
If you do,
Marita said, and then...
I didn't know it was a battle when I came.
Neither did I.
With you, it's really only you against time.
Not the time that's Catherine's.
Only because her time is different. She's panicked by it. You said tonight that all of today was only hurry. That wasn't true, but it was perceptive. And you won so well over time for so long.
Very much later, he called for the waiter and paid for the drinks, and left a good tip, and he had started the car and put on the lights and was letting out the clutch, when what had really happened came back to him again. It was back as clear and unblurred as when he had first looked into the trash burner and seen the ashes that had been stirred by the broomstick. He pushed his headlights carefully out through the quiet and empty evening of the town and followed them along the port onto the road. He felt Marita's shoulder by him and heard her say,
I know, David. It hit me too.
Don't let it.
I'm glad it did. There's nothing to do, but we'll do it.
Good.
We'll really do it. Toi et moi.
Chapter 28. At the hotel, Madame came in from the kitchen when David and Marita came into the main room. She had a letter in her hand.
Madame took the train for Biarritz, she said. She left this letter for Monsieur.
When did she go? David asked.
Immediately after Monsieur and Madame left, Madame Aurore said. She sent the boy to the station for the ticket and to reserve a wagon-lit.
David began reading the letter.
What would you eat? Madame said. Some cold chicken and a salad? An omelette to start? There's lamb, too, if Monsieur would rather. What would he like, Madame?
Marita and Madame Aurore were talking together, and David finished reading the letter. He put it in his pocket and looked at Madame Aurore.
Did she seem herself when she left?
Perhaps not, monsieur.
She'll be back, David said.
Yes, monsieur.
We will take good care of her.
Yes, monsieur.
She began to cry a little as she turned the omelet, and David put his arm around her and kissed her.
Go and talk to Madame, she said. And let me set the table. Aurore and the boy are at Naples, mixing belote and politics.
I'll set it, Marita said. Open the wine, David, please. Don't you think we should have a bottle of the Lanson?
He closed the door of the ice chest and, holding the cold bottle, untwisted the seal and loosened the wire, and then carefully moved the cork between his thumb and first finger, feeling the pinch of metal cap against his thumb and the long, cold, rounded promise of the bottle. He brought the cork out gently and poured three glasses full. Madame stood back from the stove with her glass, and they all raised their glasses. David did not know what to drink to, so he said the first words that came, which were, A nous et à la liberté. They all drank, and then Madame served the omelette, and they all drank again without making a toast.
Eat, David, please, Marita said.
All right, he said, and drank some of the wine and ate some of the omelette slowly.
Just eat a little, Marita said. It will be good for you.
Madame looked at Marita and shook her head.
Nothing is helped by your not eating, Madame told him.
Sure, said David, and ate slowly and carefully and drank the champagne that was born new each time he poured a glass. Where did she leave the car, he asked.
At the station, Madame said. The boy rode down with her. He brought back the key. It's in your room.
Was the wagon-lit crowded?
No. He put her aboard. There were very few passengers. She will have a place.
It's not a bad train, David said.
Eat some chicken, Madame said, and drink some more wine. Open another bottle. Your women are thirsty, too.
I'm not thirsty, Marita said.
Yes, you are, Madame said.
Drink up now and take a bottle with you. I know this one. It's good for him to drink good wine.
I don't want to drink too much, chérie, David said to Madame, because tomorrow was a bad day and I'd rather not feel bad too.
You won't. I know you. Just eat now to please me.
She excused herself in a few minutes and was gone for a quarter of an hour.
David ate all of his chicken and the salad, finally. And after she had come back, they all had a glass of wine together. And then David and Marita said goodnight to Madame, who was very formal now, and went out onto the terrace and looked at the night. They were both in a hurry, and David was carrying the opened bottle of wine with an ice bucket. He put it down on the stove and took Marita in his arms and kissed her. They held each other close and said nothing. And then David picked up the bucket and they walked to Marita's room. Her bed had been made up now for two people, and David put the ice bucket down on the floor and said, "Madame."
"Yes," Marita said. "Naturally."
They lay together with the night clear and cool outside and the small breeze from the sea, and Marita said,
"I love you, David, and it's so sure now."
"Sure," David thought. "Sure? Nothing is sure."
"All the time before now," Marita said. "Before I could sleep all night with you, I've thought, and thought you wouldn't like the sort of wife who couldn't sleep."
"What sort of wife are you?"
"You'll see. A happy one now."
Then he felt it was a long time before he went to sleep, but really it was not. And when he woke at the first gray light, he saw Marita in the bed beside him, and was happy until he remembered what had happened. He was very careful not to wake her, but when she stirred, he kissed her before he stepped out of bed. She smiled and said,
"Good morning, David."
And he said, "Go back to sleep, my dearest love."
She said, "All right."
And rolled over quickly like a small animal and, dark-headed, lay curled up with her closed eyes away from the light and her long, dark, shiny eyelashes against the rose-brown early morning color of her skin. David looked at her and thought how beautiful she was, and how he could see her spirit had not gone from her body when she slept. She was lovely, and her coloring and the unbelievable smoothness of her skin were almost Javanese, he thought. He watched the coloring in her face deepen as the light grew stronger. Then he shook his head and, carrying his clothing on his left arm, opened and closed the door and went out into the new morning, walking barefoot on the stones that were still wet with dew. In his and Catherine's room, he took a shower, shaved, found a fresh shirt and shorts and put them on, looked around the empty bedroom, the first morning he had ever been in it with Catherine not there, and then went out to the empty kitchen and found a tin of Maquereau Vin Blanc Capitaine Cook and opened it and took it, perilous with edge-level juice, with a cold bottle of Tuborg beer out to the bar. He opened the beer, took the bottle top between his right thumb and the first joint of his right forefinger and bent it in until it was flattened together, put it in his pocket since he saw no container to toss it into, raised the bottle that was still cold to his hand and now beaded wet in his fingers and, smelling the aroma from the open tin of spiced and marinated mackerel, he took a long drink of the cold beer, set it down on the bar and took an envelope from his hip pocket and unfolded Catherine's letter and commenced to reread it.
"David, I knew very suddenly you must know how terrible it was. Worse than hitting someone, a child is the worst, I guess, with a car. The thump on the fender or maybe just a small bump, and then all the rest of it happening and the crowd gathering to scream. The Frenchwoman screaming écraseuse even if it was the child's fault. I did it, and I knew I did it, and I can't undo it. It's too awful to understand, but it happened. I'll cut this short. I'll be back, and we'll settle things the best we can. Do not worry at all. I'll wire and write and do all the things for my book, so if you ever finish it only, I will try to do this one thing. I had to burn the other things. The worst was being righteous about it, but I don't have to tell you that. I do not ask for forgiveness, but please have good luck, and I will do everything as well as I can. Eris has been good to you and me both, and I don't hate her. I won't end it as I'd like to because it would sound too preposterous to believe, but I will say it anyway since I was always rude and presumptuous and preposterous too, lately, as we both know. I love you, and I always will, and I am sorry. What a useless word. Catherine."
After he had finished, he read it through again. He had never read any other letters from Catherine, because from the time they had met at the Crillon Bar in Paris until they were married at the American Church at Avenue Hoche, They had seen each other every day, and reading this first one now for the third time, he found that he still could be, and was, moved by her. He put the letter back in his hip pocket and ate a second small, plump, miniature mackerel in the aromatic white wine sauce and finished the cold beer. Then he went out to the kitchen for a piece of bread to sop up the liquid in the long tin and for a fresh bottle of beer. He would try to work today and would almost certainly fail. There had been too much emotion, too much damage, too much of everything, and his changing of allegiance, no matter how sound it had seemed, no matter how it simplified things for him, was a grave and violent thing, and this letter compounded the gravity and the violence. All right, Bourne, he thought as he began to drink the second beer. Don't spend time thinking how bad things are, because you know. You have three choices. Try to remember one that is gone and write it again. Second, you can try a new one. And third, write on the goddamn narrative. So sharpen up and take the best one. You always gambled when you could bet on yourself. Never bet on anything that can talk, your father said. And you said, except yourself. And he said, not me, Davy, but pile it on yourself sometime, you iron-hearted little bastard. He meant to say cold-hearted, but he turned it kindly with his gently lying mouth. Or maybe he meant it. Don't con yourself on Tuborg beer. So take the best one and write one new and good as you can. And remember, Marita has been hit as badly as you, maybe worse. So gamble. She cares as much for what we lost as you do. Chapter 29. When he finally gave up writing that day, it was afternoon. He had started a sentence as soon as he had gone into his working room, and had completed it, but he could write nothing after it. He crossed it out and started another sentence, and again came to the complete blankness. He was unable to write the sentence that should follow, although he knew it. He wrote a first simple declarative sentence again, and it was impossible for him to put down the next sentence on paper. At the end of 2 hours, it was the same. He could not write more than a single sentence, and the sentences themselves were increasingly simple and completely dull. He kept at it for 4 hours before he knew that resolution was powerless against what had happened. He admitted it without accepting it, closed and put away the notebook with the rows of crossed-out lines, and went to find the girl. She was on the terrace in the sun reading, and when she looked up and saw his face, she said, "No?" "Worse than no."
"Not at all?"
"Nope."
"Let's have a drink," Marita said.
"Good," said David. They were inside at the bar, and the day had come in with them. It was as good as the day before, and perhaps better, since summer should have been gone, and each warm day was an extra thing. "We should not waste it," David thought. "We should try to make it good and save it if we can." He mixed the martinis and poured them, and when they tasted them, they were icy cold and dry.
"You were right to try this morning," Marita said. "But let's not think about it any more today."
"Good," he said. He reached for the bottle of Gordon's, the Noyer Prague, and the stirring pitcher, poured out the water from the ice, and using his empty glass, commenced to measure out two more drinks. "It's a lovely day," he said. "What should we do?"
"Let's go swim now," Marita said, "so we won't waste the day."
"Good," David said. "Should I tell Madame that we'll be late for lunch?"
"She put a cold lunch up," Marita said. "I thought that probably you'd like to swim however work went."
"That was intelligent," David said. "How is Madame?"
"She has a slightly discolored eye," Marita said.
"No." Marita laughed. They drove up the road and around the promontory through the forest and left the car in the broken shade of the pine woods and carried the lunch basket and the beach gear down the trail to the cove. There was a little breeze from the east, and the sea was dark and blue as they came down through the stone pines. The rocks were red, and the sand of the cove was yellow and wrinkled, and the water, as they came to it, clean and now amber clear over the sand. They put the basket and the rucksack in the shade of the biggest rock and undressed, and David climbed the tall rock to dive. He stood there naked and brown in the sun, looking out to the sea.
Wanna dive? He called. She shook her head. I'll wait for you.
No,
she called up and waded out into the water up to her thighs. How is it? David called down.
Much cooler than it's ever been. Almost cold.
Good, he said. And as she watched him and waded, the water came over her belly and touched her breasts, and he straightened, rose onto his toes, seemed to hang slowly without falling, and then knifed out and down, making a boil in the water that a porpoise might have made, re-entering slickly into the hole that he had made in rising. She swam out toward the circle of milling water, and then he rose beside her and held her up and close, and then put his salty mouth against her own.
Elle est bonne, la mer, he said. Toi aussi.
They swam out of the cove and beyond into the deep water, past where the mountain dropped down into the sea, and lay on their backs and floated. The water was colder than it had been, but at the very top was warmed a little, and Marita floated with her back arched high, her head all under water but her nose, and her brown breasts were lapped gently by the movement the light breeze gave the sea. Her eyes were shut against the sun, and David was beside her in the water. His arm was under her head, and then he kissed the tip of her left breast, and then the other breast. They taste like the sea, he said.
Let's go to sleep out here.
Could you?
It's too hard to keep my back arched.
Let's swim way out and then swim in.
All right.
They swam far out, further than they had ever swum before. Far enough so they could see past the next headland and on out until they could see the broken purple line of the mountains behind the forest. They lay there in the water and watched the coast. Then they swam in slowly. They stopped to rest when they lost the mountains, and again when they lost the headland, and then swam slowly and strongly on in past the entrance to the cove and pulled themselves out on the beach.
Are you tired? David asked.
Very, Marita said. She had never swum that far before.
Are you still pounding?
Oh, I'm fine.
David walked up the beach and over to the rock and found one of the bottles of Tavel and two towels. You look like a seal, David said, sitting down beside her on the sand. He handed her the Tavel and she drank from the bottle and handed it back. He took a long drink and then on the smooth, dry sand, stretched out in the sun, the lunch basket by them, and the wine cool as they drank from the bottle. Marita said,
Catherine wouldn't have gotten tired.
The hell she wouldn't. She never swam that far.
Truly?
We swam a long way, girl. I was never out where we could see those backdrop mountains before.
All right, she said. There isn't anything we can do about her today, so let's not think about it. David?
Yes.
Do you still love me?
Yes, very much.
Perhaps I made a great mistake with you and you're just being kind to me.
You didn't make any mistakes and I'm not being kind to you.
Marita took a handful of radishes and ate them slowly and drank some wine. The radishes were young and crisp and sharp in flavor.
You don't have to worry about working, she said. I know. That will be all right.
Sure, David said.
He cut one of the artichoke hearts up with the fork and ate a chunk swirled in the mustard sauce Madame had made.
May I have the Tavel? Marita said.
She took a good swallow of the wine and set the bottle down by David, putting its base firmly in the sand and leaning it against the basket.
Isn't it a good lunch Madame made, David?
It's an excellent lunch.
Did Aurore really give her a black eye?
Not a real one.
She has a bad tongue with him.
There's the difference in age, and he was within his rights to hit her if she was insulting. She said so, at the end. And she sent you messages.
What messages?
Just loving messages.
She loves you, David said.
No, you, stupid. She's only on my side.
There aren't any sides anymore, David said.
No, Marita said. And we didn't try to make sides. It just happened.
It happened, all right.
David handed her the jar with the cut-up artichoke heart and the dressing, and found the second bottle of Tavel. It was still cool. He took a long drink of the wine.
We've been burned out, he said. Crazy woman burned out the Bournes.
Are we the Bournes?
Sure, we're the Bournes. It may take a while to have the papers, but that's what we are. Do you want me to write it out? I think I could write that.
You don't need to write it.
I'll write it in the sand, David said. They slept well and naturally through the late afternoon, and when the sun was low, Marita woke and saw David lying in the bed by her side. His lips were closed and he was breathing very slowly, and she looked at his face and his covered eyes that she had only seen lidded in sleep twice before, and looked at his chest and his body with the arms straight by his sides. She went over to the door of the bathroom and looked at herself in the full-length mirror. Then she smiled at the mirror. When she was dressed, she went out to the kitchen and talked with Madame. Later, David was still asleep and she sat by him on the bed. In the dusk, his hair was whitish against his dark face, and she waited for him to wake. They sat at the bar and were both drinking Hague Pinch and Perrier. Marita was being very careful with her drink. She said,
I think you should go to town every day and get the papers and have a drink and read by yourself. I wish there was a club or a real café where you met your friends.
There isn't.
Well, I think it would be good every day for you to be away from me for a while when you're not working. You've been overrun with girls. I'm always going to see you have your men friends. That's one thing very bad that Catherine did.
Not on purpose, and it was my own fault.
Maybe that's true. But do you think we'll have friends? Good friends?
We each have one already.
Will we have others?
Maybe.
Will they take you away because they know more than I do?
They won't know more.
Will they come along young and new and fresh with new things and you'll be tired of me?
They won't and I won't be.
I'll kill them if they do. I'm not going to give you away to anyone the way she did.
That's good.
I want you to have men friends and friends from the war and to shoot with and to play cards at the club. But we don't have to have you have women friends, do we? Fresh, new ones who will fall in love and really understand you and all that?
I don't run around with women. You know that.
They are new all the time, Marita said. There are new ones every day. No one can ever be sufficiently warned. You most of all.
I love you, David said. And you're my partner, too. But take it easy. Just be with me.
I'm with you.
I know it. And I love to look at you and know you're here and that we'll sleep together and be happy. In the dark, Marita lay against him, and he felt her breasts against his chest and her arm behind his head, and her hand touching him and lips against his.
I'm your girl, she said in the dark. Your girl. No matter what, I'm always your girl. Your good girl who loves you.
Yes, my dearest love. Sleep well. Sleep well.
You go to sleep first, Marita said. And I'll be back in a minute.
He was asleep when she came back, and she got in under the sheet and lay beside him. He was sleeping on his right side and breathing softly and steadily. Chapter 30. David woke in the morning when the first light came in the window. It was still gray outside, and there were different pine trunks than the ones he usually woke to see, and a longer gap beyond them toward the sea. His right arm was stiff because he had slept on it. Then, awake, he knew he was in a strange bed and he saw Marita lying sleeping by him. He remembered everything and he looked at her lovingly and covered her fresh brown body with the sheet and then kissed her very lightly again and putting on his dressing gown walked out into the dew-wet early morning carrying the image of how she looked with him to his room. He took a cold shower, shaved, put on a shirt and a pair of shorts and walked down to his working room. He stopped at the door of Marita's room and opened it very carefully. He stood and looked at her sleeping, and closed the door softly and went into the room where he worked. He got out his pencils and a new cahier, sharpened 5 pencils,
and began to write the story of his father and the raid in the year of the Maji Maji Rebellion that had started with the trek across the Bitter Lake. He made the crossing now and completed the dreadful trek of the first day, when the sunrise had caught them with the part that had to be done in the dark only half finished, and the mirages already making as the heat became unbearable. By the time the morning was well advanced and a strong, fresh east breeze was blowing through the pines from the sea, he had finished the night at the first camp under the fig trees where the water came down from the escarpment, and was moving out of the camp in the early morning and up the long draw that led to the steep cut onto the escarpment. He found he knew much more about his father than when he had first written this story, and he knew he could measure his progress by the small things which made his father more tactile, and to have more dimensions than he had in the story before. He was fortunate just now that his father was not a simple man. David wrote steadily and well, and the sentences that he had made before came to him complete and entire, and he put them down, corrected them, and cut them as if he were going over proof. Not a sentence was missing, and there were many that he put down as they were returned to him without changing them. By 2 o'clock he had recovered, corrected, and improved what it had taken him 5 days to write originally. He wrote on a while longer now, and there was no sign that any of it would ever cease returning to him intact.
The End. You've been listening to The Garden of Eden by Ernest Hemingway, narrated by Patrick Wilson. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Clipper catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Clipper audiobook, or for a copy of our latest listings, please call us using the telephone number on the back of this book. Clipper Audio is also represented on the World Wide Web at www.wfhouse.co.uk. That's www.wfhoes.co.uk. Here you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or read narrator profiles and author interviews. And thank you for listening to Clipper Audiobooks.